With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, college football fans across the nation and around the world. This is Tim May with the Tim May Podcast, recording live here on a frosty, what would you call it, Awesome Ward, a frosty Monday morning in Columbus, Ohio. How would you describe it?
A crisp, beautiful day. Just reminds me of being back at home in Casper and Laramie. Just bring on all that snow. Let's get it. Let's go make some snowmen. Let's go sledding, have some hot chocolate. This is the one that we've been waiting for.
Yeah, I've always wondered what it would be like to live in Oslo, and now I know, Oslo, Norway. So for the next several days, we're like, you know, throw six or seven more logs on the fire and get after it. But the bottom line is, you know, the Super Bowl is done. College football recruiting signing day is done. It looks like crazy season in the coaching realm is done, maybe at least for Ohio State. Agreed, awesome.
Well, Tennessee is always the one that's going to drive that conversation for everybody else. And the craziness also happens to be centered there most of the time. So I think now we're finally done. Looks like after all, Washington said no, that they wound up with – they actually offered it to several other people after all, Washington. And finally – got one from another Big Ten school on Monday. So I think that now we can finally move on.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're going to talk about that in our segment after my special guest, Albert Breer, of the Monday Morning Quarterback fame, SI.com. I mean, I've been wanting to have him on my show for a while, been trying to figure out how to do it, and he finally agreed to do it. And most people who know of Albert Breer know of two things. He is quite the meticulous, great reporter. And number two, he's an Ohio State fan. He went to Ohio State. He worked at the Lantern, and while he was at Ohio State, as he said, he even got to know the great Tim May during that time. So, it's really interesting to talk to these young guys who come along and become just step up and become big time successes in our business, man. And, you know, and he and I talked even a little bit about how the business has changed since even he got into it as a Cub Lantern reporter, and, you know, how some newspapers rolled with it, but most of them didn't, et cetera. And we just had a great conversation, including about Urban Meyer, what kind of head coach he'll be in the NFL, where does Justin Fields fit, et cetera. But, you know, you've interacted with Albert a couple times, I think, and quite the interesting character, right?
Sharp guy. I wonder, like, you're always so generous. I'm on your show to pat you on the back. Like, I can't think that there's ever been a Lantern reporter who hasn't like had time with you and got to pick your brain about your career. Like how many of them are there out there? They're like, man, I remember all that time with Tim May and the tips that he gave me and stories that he told about Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson. I mean, there's gotta be such a long list of guys that, and girls that have gone to you. And I always thought that was really cool how like holding court back when we actually got to be in the Woody before press conferences, and you'd get to be your celebrity and then go off to the side with the Lantern and give your tips.
You know what's funny, though, is they bring up conversations I basically don't ever remember. I mean, but that happens with me and my wife a lot, too. But the bottom line, yeah, it is interesting, you know, because you can – there's all kinds of impacts you can have in life. You know, I'm sure I've pissed off some people along the way, you know, and who knows. But, I mean, I've always tried to be – a nice guy to almost everybody, because you never know, you know, you never know what's going to come around and help you down the road. But also, you know, everybody needs a little bit of guidance every now and then in this profession, especially. Yeah. But as Albert and I even talked about, you know, you never give up your sources to anybody. You know, I mean, you tell them, though, you give them some pointers on maybe how to develop them and things like that. But you and I both know, man, you know, sources are the wellspring of our business.
Well, that's the other part. You said it. I mean, be nice to people. Like,
yeah,
it's pretty easy. You should do that in everything, but especially in this. If you want to have any kind of career, this is a people industry, and I know there are lots that can say that, but you know, it's not like the sources, like you get really good at, you know, cutting down a tree or, you know, being a farmer, like inanimate objects. Like sources are human beings. So if you're going to be, if you have the choice to be a nice person or a mean person, who do you like to deal with? That's a pretty easy way to go.
And it is a choice, ladies and gentlemen. It is a choice. You're not born. I was going almost said a bad word there. You're not born a meanie. There we go. I'll leave it at meanie. But you know what? Before we get to that, I want to alert people that you and I are going to come back and we're going to talk about the addition of Paul Rhodes, for example, to the meeting rooms at Ohio State. Ryan Day taking that plunge and bringing in an analyst that can maybe point out things, et cetera. You and I are going to discuss how maybe that relationship, that chemistry is going to work, you know, and we'll talk about, you know, a few other things in the coaching carousel as they pertain to Ohio State. But that'll come after first this interview I had with Albert Breer, one of my favorite people. And as promised, ladies and gentlemen, I'm back with the Monday morning quarterback, Albert Breer. Albert, welcome to the Tim May podcast. Finally, man, I've been wanting to have you on for a while. You didn't know that, but I wanted to give you a break a little bit during the season. I know you work your rear end off, as anybody reads the Monday morning quarterback knows, and throughout the week, but welcome to the Tim May podcast.
I can't tell you what a huge honor it is to be on with the Dean of the Ohio State beat, Tim. For anybody
Dean
out there who doesn't know,
go ahead, man.
Yeah, when I was trying to make it and I was a kid writing for the Lantern at, back in 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, this guy right here was the king of the Ohio State beat. So I'm being serious about this, Tim. It's an honor to be on with you.
Was I nice to you? I mean, what do you remember about
your relationship? You were. You probably didn't know who I was, but you were. I thought most of the people on the beat then were. And I remember, I interned at Channel 10 for a summer, so I was around the team a lot then. And that was when, it was Ryan Miller was one of the anchors there. And obviously Dom was there.
Yeah.
And then Jeff Hogan was the lead sports anchor, I believe. And I think he wound up going over to news, right, eventually.
Yes.
But those were the guys at Channel 10. And then, of course, all those years at the Lantern. So, yeah, man, I got fond memories of those times, no question.
Oh, yeah, man, I got fond memories of every football season, one way or the other. Like I always said, you were there in 98, 99, 2000, 2001. You and I were talking before the show started. And that's what spices up a beat. You know, everybody thinks Ohio State's just been kicking everybody's rear end forever, right? And what spices up the beat is when there's a little dip, The problem would, like I've told everybody, if I was covering Indiana or Northwestern football, I probably wouldn't have done it more than 4 or 5 years. Because Ohio State eventually gets back to the upper realm, the elite. Hey, real quick, did it break your heart what happened in the national championship game, or did you get enough juice out of the Ohio State beating Clemson to kind of carry you through? Because you are, I think, deep in your soul, an Ohio State football fan.
Yeah. You know, it's actually the one team I still root for, and it's great for me because, I think, and you probably experienced this too, and I think anybody who gets into this business experiences this, is that it takes it out of you a little bit. It's sort of, I think with the NFL, people look at me like I'm crazy when I tell them I don't root for anybody, but it really does become that way, where you start to kind of, look at the people as individual people and you look at the teams as businesses and, you look at it as something you cover, and, naturally there are people that, you feel good when they do well, but it really sort of takes, it disconnects you a little bit from some of the reasons why you got into it in the first place, which, were the passion that you had for it and that you grew up rooting for certain teams and everything else. And so, following Ohio State has been great for me that way. And that, I never really I covered college football for a little while when I got out of school, but never for very long. And so I was able to sort of kind of, continue to be a fan of my alma mater.
Yeah.
While everything else was sort of being ripped away from me, rooting for any of the pro teams sort of became, it just sort of like naturally, it stopped, And so, I was at the national championship game. I went with some of my fraternity brothers and, and that was awesome. And, you know, we had a great time with it, and it's been awesome seeing where Ryan's brought the program over the last couple of years, because, you know, he's from up here, actually. He's from the, you know, not far from where I grew up. And, you know, I knew him a little bit when he was coaching in the NFL, and thought he did a great job there. And, you know, so I think he's got the program in a great spot, and I would have loved to have seen us beat Alabama. You know, that was an incredible, incredible Alabama team. So stung a little bit that night, but I know the future's still bright.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, they got revenge. You know, it's tough now because you got to win two games, win a national championship. Yep. And, you know, they get revenge on Clemson. The next thing you know, they run into what I've called, and people on my podcast get tired of hearing me say this all the time, but that was the best Alabama offense I've seen. I grew up an Alabama fan back in the 60s. You know, mm-hmm. I went to games when Bear Bryant was still the coach, you know, with in the early 60s, Bear, you know, Joe Namath, et cetera. But that was as potent an Alabama offense as I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And,
well,
and Mac Jones, the way he was able to hit.
I mean, from an NFL standpoint too, you think about it. Like,
oh, dude.
The amount, yeah. I mean, first round picks, like, and what they've had go through the program in the last 2 years, really, you know, and Jerry Jeudy and Henry Ruggs last year. And Devontae Smith, who, I mean, I don't know how, I don't know if he can hold up at the NFL level because of his, right. his build, but I mean, as good a college receiver as I think I've ever seen. I mean, and watching him in person, you know, in Miami, at the, like, it's unbelievable what that guy does with his body. And I still remember, you know, I remember talking to a couple scouts about him last year, and, you know, it's interesting because he didn't come out. He could have come out last year. Maybe it would have been a first round pick, maybe not coming out if he'd come out last year. And I had a scout that I really, really respect, who I go to on a lot of things, say to me, we were talking about Ruggs and Jeudy. And he said, but you know, the best one's still in school. And I'm like, what? He's like, no, the best one's still in school. And other scouts had told me, like, oh, like, this guy's 160 pounds soaking wet. Like, we don't know if he'll make it in the NFL. And this one college scouting director said to me, he's like, trust me, this is the best one. He's better than Jeudy. He's better than Ruggs. He's the best one. Wow. And I think, you know, he obviously showed that. And I've gone back to the scout and I gave him props for it and everything else because he was right. You know, and but yeah, seeing the talent that's gone through that program, and what people don't even talk about is the offensive line, which, you know, when I talk to some NFL folks about it, it's interesting. The NFL people I talk to believe that all five of the starters on that offensive line at Alabama this year will wind up being NFL starters, which is just bananas. You know what I mean? Like,
wow. Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So like, you think about that. So we're talking about the skill guys and Najee Harris and Billingsley and Mechie and obviously Devontae Smith and Mac Jones. And then those guys have five starting NFL offensive linemen in front of them. It's a really incredible group, and I had high hopes going in, but those got dashed pretty quickly.
I was going to say, though, you know, like I've told people, you know, if you had to take two people off of Ohio State just before that game to really affect the way they were doing business at the end of the year last year, it was Tommy Togiai at defensive tackle, nose guard, and Trey Sermon, the running back. Not that they were necessarily the best players on their sides of the ball, but everything hinged a lot of what Ohio State did and a lot of what it could have done against Alabama hinged on the basic abilities of those two guys, you know? And yeah, it was tough, man. I mean, for Ohio State. And I wanted to ask you real quick. I mean, Tommy Togiai declared, you know, for the draft. What's your take on it? Let's just jump into it a little bit. What's your take on him?
I mean, I think, you know, I think the player you want to watch with him, and it's sort of interesting because I would relate him a little bit to Vita Vey, who, you know, I don't know that he's the athlete that Vita Vey was coming out of Washington a couple of years ago, but it's really easy to pat the Buccaneers in the back for that pick now. But if you want to go back a couple of years and you hear the way that some people were talking about that pick, and you remember they took him over Derwin James, and Derwin James is a really good player just like right away for the Chargers coming out of Florida State. And the Bucs took the Bucs took some criticism for that and saying, well, you took a guy who is an outdated defensive tackle. He's less of an athlete. He's a run stopper. Vita Vey was one of the best players and most valuable players in the Super Bowl. And so, you know, I do think a lot of times these things work on comps. And so I think for a guy like Tommy Togiai, one of the issues over the last few years would have been, well, can you find an impact player in the NFL who looks like him? And is this an outdated defensive tackle? The big run stuffing nose, like, is that not, like, is what you're looking at there still have the value that it might have had 10 or 20 years ago? And then you see somebody like Vita Vea, and it's like, okay, like, now you see what Tampa's able to do with him. And now maybe a team looks at it and says, with a Tommy Togiai, yeah, you know, we can still make use of the bigger defensive tackle, and he doesn't need to be strictly a run player. He can help us in the passing game too. So yeah, I still think he's probably a day two pick, you know, round two, round three. But I think that somebody like Vita Vea, who was the 12th pick in the draft, definitely helps him.
Yeah, I was going to say, see, you're barking right at my tree, man. I'm an A-gap. I'm an A-gap stuffer. but get up field, I mean, you know, if I'm getting a defense together, it affects the offense and the quarterback so much. If you can get any kind of, like, consistent pressure in the A-gap, and I'm talking about, you know, a guy that you've got to deal with on every play that gives your center and your left or right guard a headache, you know. I mean, I just think that is so crucial.
It's occupying blockers too. I mean, that's what the Bucs did, you know, and it's interesting because, like, if you want to talk in the passing game, I did a story with Todd Bowles today on,
excellent. You know, I was going to ask you about it.
On what they did. And, you know, he brought up Vita again with, you know, being able to stop the run with a 6-man box.
Yes.
How that helped them, you know, like, deal with the Chiefs passing game. Okay. Like, now we can put two safeties back without compromising much because we can stop the run with a 6-man box. And so that helps us stop the passing game because we're able to deal with the running game with less people. So, you know, I do think, you know, you're onto something there with a player like Togiai. It does help you change the math to some degree, and that he can occupy multiple blockers. He can make it easier to stop the run, which can help you put another player on the field. There's different ways to play. And, you know, I think, again, like, somebody like Togiai is an interesting prospect because he does bring something unique to the table, which is, you know, his athleticism for his size and obviously freakish strength, which, it's too bad because I did hear some whispers about him. You know, you always hear this time of year, who's going to break this record or that record. Usually it's the 40, you know, like someone's going to make a run at, you know, I guess it would be John Ross's record in the 40 now.
Yeah.
You know, well, I'd heard some rumblings that Tommy might've had a decent shot at the bench press record.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, you got short arms, you know, they have to go very far. That's why I always look at it. You know, no, you're right. I mean, it's interesting. I want to jump into that Todd Bowles thing you did on Monday Morning Quarterback. As we record this, it's Monday morning. I'm sitting in frosty Hilliard, Ohio, where it's 14 degrees. You're sitting where, Albert?
Duxbury, Massachusetts, where it's probably, I can look it up. It was actually, we had wind chill under zero on Friday and Saturday.
Yeah.
But it's warmed up a little bit. It's like, it's bad. It's like a nice, like, 33 right now, I think, something like that, right around there.
Well, my wife's family's from that area, by the way. We got married. My wife and I got married to Martha Mary Chapel in Sudbury, Massachusetts, which is over by Longfellow's Wayside Inn. I don't know if you've ever been over there.
You know, that's my hometown, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm just messing with you. But,
But
we got married.
You told me that story before, and I couldn't remember. All right, good.
Yeah, matter of fact, I think I told you when I first met my then grandfather-in-law, he passed out. So, yeah, such as what it was. Yeah, I think he had too much lamb at the Longfellow's Wayside Inn.
Yeah,
but I digress. No, the bottom line is, I'm reading that Monday Morning Quarterback this week, and the Todd Bowles story. The only thing you didn't have in there was do your job, you know, which is what Bill Belichick rants and raves at his players in certain times. But keep it simple, stupid was pretty much the approach. And number two, I'm just going, you know, this was exactly the kind of defense I thought Ohio State was going to play against Alabama, which was don't let Devontae Smith just come off the line and make a cut, you know, and get wide open
at the line. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But they did come out with that four linebacker look for the most part. Did a decent job, but Mac Jones was able to get rid of the ball so fast to a wide open receiver. It didn't really matter. And it's funny because you read a story and it's talking about one thing, but you're applying it to something else. But Todd Bowles, what a resurrection for him and his career, et cetera. Right. I mean, yeah. The last year,
I mean, he's done a, you know, it's actually kind of cool for me too. Cause I go back with him a little bit. I was covering the Cowboys for the Dallas Morning News when he was the secondary coach there, and everybody sort of knew he was going places. You know, yeah. And I think, like, you know, if you, and when I was covering the team, it was when Wade Phillips was the coach and they still had some of the Parcells guys left over. You know, and Todd had a secondary that had, you know, had some characters in it. You had, you know, Terrence Newman and Roy Williams and Anthony Henry. And, you know, one of the things about Todd was he always got the most out of people, you know, and he always had this like level of, yeah, I think players really genuinely believe like this guy is going to get the most out of me. And this guy's got my back and this guy is going to put me in a position to succeed. And in the NFL, that's the name of the game, you know, because the goal of all of these guys is to be rich. I mean, you boil it down, it's to win, it's to put rings on your fingers. Yes, all of that. But the goal is to make money, you know, and the goal is to get rich. And so, you know, I think, you know, the demeanor of a coach matters, but you know, what really counts is, can you help me do my job at the best, at the highest level I possibly can? And that's the way I look at Bowles, is that he's always been able to get the most out of people, out of the people that he coaches. And so, yeah, I think he just sort of was a victim of circumstance a little bit in New York. And, yeah, I don't need to go chapter and verse through the way everything worked there, but he got them to a 10-win season his first year. They didn't rip the Band-Aid off because of that until 3 years into his tenure. And everything sort of went sideways with the rebuild. I do think he's somebody who's learned from the first time around. And, you know, I think he'd do a great job if he got another shot, you know. A lot of times people look at retreads and say, well, you know, like, well, he failed over here. But you look at some of the most successful coaches in NFL history. I mean, Mike Shanahan was fired by the Raiders. Bill Belichick was fired by the Browns. Andy Reid was fired by the Eagles. Now, I know that's a little different type of retread, but yeah, I don't think anybody was looking at Andy Reid as this innovator 8 years ago when he got fired by Philly. People had thought, like, sort of that his time had passed. And, you know, look at him now. So, you know, I do think Bowles, you know, the same way those guys got their second shot, would do really well with a second shot somewhere.
Bruce Arians, I mean, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he just won the Super Bowl. You know, Gruden, you know, goes to Tampa Bay and wins the Super Bowl, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, et cetera. You're exactly right. Speaking of, you just led me into the path I was wanting to go down anyway. So how is Urban Meyer going to do at Jacksonville, in your opinion? Obviously, I don't know if you call it a gap.
I'd love to hear your opinion on that, Tim. You've been around more than
Here's my opinion on that. And I've given it to quite a few outlets. This guy, Urban Meyer, is a very intelligent man, number one. Number two, does he hate losing? Without a doubt. You know, does it eat at him? Absolutely. But that was in college football, Albert. You lose one game in college football, and unless you're Alabama and occasionally Ohio State or somebody, your big dream is done. You know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, you can't lose. And so, you hate losing when you're a college football coach above everything else. He's smart enough to know that you can lose five or six games in the NFL and still make the playoffs, you know, number one. I think he's almost stated that to a certain extent from some of the interviews I've seen. I had him on my podcast a few times over this past year and stuff. And you know, I wouldn't say he had mellowed, but he is always studying the game in some form or fashion. And he didn't jump into this just on a backflip off the side of the pool. You know, he climbed up to the top rung of the diving board and jumped in. The way I looked at it, he was studying it all the way. And then, you know, of course, I don't know if you call it a gaffe, but hiring the former strength coach from Iowa and then having to unceremoniously basically fire him a week into his job. I think that was an eye opener to maybe some of the political pressure, whatever you want to call it, that you're going to run into that maybe you didn't at Ohio State. Of course, he did have his tough situation there in the Zach Smith thing, but there were a lot of levels of that that weren't uncovered. In my opinion, or lightly covered. But the bottom line is, I think he's going to be it's all who you surround yourself with, as you just pointed out a minute ago about Todd Bowles in this situation. And after he left the Jets, who would have, you know, who would have picked him up off the side of the road? Now he's a Super Bowl champion. So I think Urban is smart enough. He has studied the game. I think he knows talent you saw him standing front and center in front of Trevor Lawrence at his workout the other day. He and I were talking about Trevor Lawrence five, seven, eight weeks ago. He really likes this guy. You know, everything's tailor-made for him to succeed there. I don't know if you agree or not from the standpoint of.
Yeah, I mean, I, Tim, I think you're with me on this. Like, I don't think he goes there if they don't have the first pick, right?
Yeah, like I don't either.
And if you look at it, like, and if you talk to, and yes, it's Jacksonville, but if you talk to guys who are in the running for these jobs, head coach or GM candidates, they all viewed, most of them viewed Jacksonville as the most attractive one. You have multiple picks in the first round, multiple picks in the second round, multiple picks in the fourth round. I mean, it's $100 million in cap space, patient ownership, a generational quarterback prospect coming out available with the first overall pick. There's so many things that are in place there where you can build it from the ground up and you're going to have a chance to kind of mold the place in your own image and the way you see fit. And so I think in a lot of ways it is perfect for Urban. I had some of those conversations with Urban over the last, year or two also since he's been out. And I think the most interesting thing was how hard he studied the NFL. And that sort of told me, I think it was a tell that he was at least going to dip his toe in the water and take the temperature of it and see, is there somewhere that would fit for me? I think that like a lot of what he, walked away from it with was, like how important culture was, and that's his specialty, right? Like I think more than an X's and O's coach, he's a culture coach. I think one of the things that really kind of came out of that for him was like, it's not the disparity in talent from one team to the other, because there are good players everywhere in the NFL. And the difference from one team to the next is much, much smaller in the NFL than it is in the SEC or in the Big Ten or in the Pac-12 or in the ACC. There's a reason why each guy there is in the NFL. So I think he felt like, in a game that's won on the margins, the NFL's won on the margins, he could find a way to own the margins. And it's so interesting too, because I know this is sort of a long-winded answer, but you're talking about college to pro. Sort of goes back to something I remember Chip Kelly telling me after he left the Eagles. And Chip said that he felt like the biggest difference between the NFL and college was situational football. And I was like, that's interesting. What do you mean? He says, well, he's like, in the NFL, like, whatever it was, 80% of the games are won by 7 points or less. So what does that mean? That means third down's really important. That means red zone's really important. That means, the last 2 minutes of each half is really important. It's like in college football, he's like, I could roll the balls out and win 9 of my games by multiple scores. He's like, and then there'd be 3 or 4 games where it wasn't like that, and I could prepare myself for those games. In the NFL, every game was like those games. And so I had to become a lot better at situational football. And I think that's sort of a microcosm of what the NFL is. The difference in talent from team to team is so small that every game has to be won on the margins. And I think Urban probably, just my sense, like through his study of this, talking to his ex-players and all the different places and his coaching connections through the league, okay, like this game's won on the margins. Can I own the margins? And I think he feels like with the program that he cultivated from Bowling Green to Utah to Florida to Ohio State, he had a program that was going to be equipped to win on the margins.
Yeah, no, that's it in a nutshell. And, that's what I always remind people, the NFL, even the worst team is a team of all-stars, when you think about it in one form or fashion. That's why I always laugh when they say Alabama could line up and go play back in the day Buffalo and beat Buffalo. Maybe one time out of 10, the way I looked at it, Because everybody on Buffalo, is a great, in some form or fashion was a great player, great prospect. So, you're exactly right. And here's the thing before we move on, the thing about Urban that I think sets him apart from a lot of guys I've covered, and Jim Trussell was like this a lot too, but he knows where the buttons are. I mean, he figures out where your buttons are, and he pushes them both good and bad. And that's his motivational secret, if that's what you want to call it. And I'm not just talking about with players, I'm talking about with coaches. I mean, he's on his coaches as much as he is on his players. And man, if you do good things for him, you definitely get rewarded. And if you don't,
he has his inner circle. I mean, that's the thing is like, and I do think that that's part of it with him. Like, and I've always felt this way. The people who are his guys are loyal to him for life. Right.
Yeah.
Like Alex Smith, Tim Tebow. I mean, you even talk to like a Brandon Spikes and what he says all these years later about playing for Urban Meyer. You know, you talk about some of the guys who went through Ohio State and played for him, you know, you know, the Bosas or Mike Thomas or Marshawn Lattimore or, you know, the guys who've been really successful in the NFL, they're all really loyal to him. Well, why? Because he helped them get where they needed to go. And because they bought in to what he was selling, he's got a very, very high level of loyalty to them.
And but so you know intrigues me that I think is similar between him and Saban and Belichick of just three guys.
Yeah.
They stay aloof enough from their players and fellow coaches to where they have no problem telling them something to their face. If you follow my drift there. I mean, there's never any doubt that he's in charge. If you follow what I'm saying. And no, you're exactly right. But you know, like even with Tom Herman, when he was at Ohio State, when he first got there, you know, like I asked him about that, about moving on, becoming a head coach sometime. He goes, he wanted to stay there with Ohio State long enough to play for and maybe win a national championship because he knew the Urban Meyer way would get them there. But there are a lot of guys that, you know, working for Urban, it's a every day. What have you done? What are you doing today? Not what did you do yesterday? What are you doing today? And what's coming on the agenda? You know, the boot is always in play.
And that's what intrigues me about it is that, you know, I do think programs like that in the NFL, you have to win quickly. You know what I mean? Like, I think like Belichick's program, right? Like, so, and look at the way it is, like Belichick for that to work in New England had to win quickly. And there were some people there that felt like after that 5-11 year in 2000, like, there were rumors, but there've been, I've heard stuff since then. Like, you know, obviously I wasn't covering the NFL at the time. I was still in college then, but, you know, I've heard stories about how some coaches' houses were on the market. Some of the New England coaches' houses were on the market in 2001, because they felt like we might be in trouble here. They went 5-11 their first year. They started 0-2 that second year. You know, then obviously Mo Lewis hits Drew Bledsoe, Tom Brady goes in the game, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
And now it becomes easier to sell your program because all you got to do is point at the trophy case and say, look at how many millionaires I've made. Look at how many millionaires have come through here. You know, but if you don't win quickly, it can be a problem. And I think Saban ran into that too. You know, he was 9-7 his first year in Miami, the hard place to play though. And they picked the wrong quarterback. You know, Dante Culpepper over Drew Brees in 2006, and the wheels sort of came off, and then all of a sudden you have the grumbling. You know, I think one of the things that made it easy for Urban to sell his program at Florida and Ohio State is that he already had credibility at that level. Like, I think to sell a tough program, and I expect he'll run a tough program, you have to have results, you know?
Yeah.
And so I do think that, like, finding a way to get results quickly is going to be important.
Yeah, I think what struck Saban right in square between the eyes, though, was that he was not the ultimate decision maker, you know. I know that, you know, you've been around Saban, that had to drive him nuts, you know.
Right. And, a doctor tells you can't sign Drew Brees.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I could tell you, like that's the way it works in a lot of NFL buildings. Like, you know, this time of year, especially, like, guys come, you know, the owner like has a doc, like has the, you know, hires the team doctor, and the team doctor is, in a lot of cases, these are very well respected guys, you know, nationally renowned orthopedic doctors. And, you know, a lot of times, like, the owner will say to the coach, I'm paying him to look at the medicals. Like, you can't overrule him. You know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
Like, this guy's here for a reason. And I think for college coaches, maybe sometimes that can be a little jarring, and seeing like, oh, this is an actual like business. Like, there's a full on operation here where I can't just overrule whoever I want.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like buying a used car, and the mechanic you take it to says, no, man, this wheel's going to fall off eventually.
Yeah,
I think his wheel finally may have fallen off this year, but you know what I'm talking about with Drew Brees. He had he's like buying a used Mercedes or something. But
it was tough to. I mean, I watching Drew in that last game. It's tough to watch in that last game.
When he turned and looked back at the stadium, though, when he was leaving, I was watching on television, and I'm just going, wow, man, that might have been his last glance. And what a career. Because you all remember, you were covering Ohio State when he beat Ohio State.
Oh, yeah. No. Hey, listen, like I always tell people, I was in the Big Ten at the same time as Tom Brady and Drew Brees.
Yeah. One was too slow and one was too short. Yeah.
My freshman year, Tom Brady was the quarterback of Michigan. Drew Brees was the quarterback of Purdue. And I believe the Big Ten Offensive Player of the Year was, can you get this?
Oh, wait a minute. It wouldn't have been, what's his face at Wisconsin. Who was it?
Joe Germain.
That's right.
How about that? Yeah. Joe Germain was the Big Ten Offensive Player of the Year.
One 20 minute span of football cost Joe Germain going down in history. I'm telling you.
We're
talking about against Michigan State in 98.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
One 20 minute span. Hey, real quick, let's, cause I don't want to keep up too much of your time here. I did want to ask you this though. As you look at this upcoming draft, is Trevor Lawrence, in your opinion, by far the number one pick as you look at it right now, based on that workout the other day? And then people want to know from your vantage point, where does Justin Fields fall into this?
Sure. So, Trevor Lawrence is to me in a separate category. And that's not an affront to anyone else. Justin Fields, Zach Wilson, Trey Lance. It's just, it is what it is. And I, you know, this isn't based on my evaluation. I'm not a scout. I can see what everybody else can see, but I'm not a scout. But having talked to scouts, about the kid for the last 2 years, he's the next one that sort of has that generational tag. And, you know, I think that really to me, in my lifetime, which is sort of a simple time frame for me to look at it, and talking to scouts who have been doing this for a long time, like some longer than I've been alive, four guys are in that category. And it's John Elway, it's Peyton Manning, it's Andrew Luck, and it's Trevor Lawrence. So I think that sort of can contextualize how Trevor Lawrence is seen by the NFL community. And also, I mean, like we were talking about, a big reason why, you know, this is the right opportunity for Urban. And then I think it's sort of a race to see who can go number two. I think that the next three are sort of seen in a cluster, and, you know, they all have questions. So, you know, with Zach Wilson, I think it's more like, does his game translate the way he plays? Because he plays sort of a Mahomes type of style.
Yes.
And is his frame big enough? Physically, can he take hits at the next level? He doesn't have the arm strength that Mahomes does, but he's got a really good arm. You know, he's accurate. He's fast. There's going to be questions about him not being a captain at BYU. And mark it down. That's going to come up a lot over the next 2 months. So there's that with Zach Wilson. With Justin Fields, is how fast does he see the field? The one thing you hear with Justin a lot is that he just needs to play more, you know, and that with experience, he'll get better. But physically with Justin, it's all there. He's accurate. He's big. He's strong. He's fast. I think he really could have, like, from what I've heard, and I'm sure you've heard the same stuff, he really could have burned up the 40 in Indy, which would have really helped him. So he might be a guy who's hurt a little bit by the combine not happening.
Yeah.
And then Trey Lance, I still think that there's this perception, you know, level of play. He had the one game this year that he didn't play all that well in. He's only got one full year as a starter. So I think like those three are all seen as having like franchise quarterback tools, but they all have holes. And it sort of becomes, what are you most comfortable with? And which of these holes do you think the player can work past? Like with Zach Wilson, can he take the hits? Can he put on some weight? Can he adjust his style of play? With Justin Fields, can he learn to see it a little bit faster? When things get muddy on him, can he learn to play? Can he learn to handle those situations a little bit better? And then with Trey Lance, how does he project to a higher level of competition? And you know about North Dakota State. I mean, the players he has aren't as good as Ohio State. They aren't as good as Clemson. But I like they're way better than their competition, right? Like, yeah. So he's playing with an advantage on a week-to-week basis, and that program is an absolute juggernaut at the level he's playing at. So, yeah, I think with each of these guys, it's sort of like when you get past the physical tools and you look at some of the things they need to work on, like, who are you comfortable with as far as their ability to work through that stuff? Yeah. And so that's why I think like the interviews are going to be massive for these kids, you know, because, and they're all going to happen over Zoom this year. I think you're going to get to the pro days and these guys are going to show they have it physically, you know, and then the question is going to be in the Zoom interviews, like how these teams are testing them, because really for the quarterbacks, I think it's going to be a huge part this year of which order they go in. And right now I would say if I had to, you know, like kind of like gather a consensus on the way they fall right now, I'd say Lawrence obviously won. And then probably Wilson, Fields, Lance. And I think all four of those guys have a really good shot to go inside the top 10.
Yeah, I was on Bo Bishop and James Laurinaitis' radio show the other day, and we were talking about the quarterbacks. I said, you know what bugs me about Wilson? We had talked about this a couple of weeks earlier, but I didn't bring it up. I said, you know, I don't like his if I'm a nitpicker, I don't like the way he finishes his throws, meaning he throws – he throws like a curveball instead of throwing that, you know, index finger down into the ground like you're taught, the quarterback to snap it off. The pros will nitpick on that. But when you look at Lance, you go, yeah, the guy's had a phenomenal career, yet the windows are so huge in FCS that you're throwing into. And I'm just wondering, too, whether Wentz is sort of like Rise, but getting to a certain level and now falling off is going to make people – sort of like, you know, look more and more to the guys who have played against like personnel, you know what I mean? And that's where when you play at Ohio State and in Clemson and Alabama, not every game is like that.
Like, I think that's why Justin, like, you know, the Bama game didn't go great, you know, but I think when you look at the two Clemson games, I mean, that's you know, like the Alabama tape might be the first one that NFL teams pull on Justin. But I guarantee you the next two will be the two Clemson games. And he played really well in those games. The loss, he played well in the loss too. Like, so, you know, I think like teams are going to look at that and say, okay, like there's something we can work with here. And I think the other part that's sort of interesting about it too, Tim, some of the questions you heard about Justin Fields aren't that different than the questions you heard on Justin Herbert last year. And so I sort of wonder if Justin Herbert's success like makes people think, okay, like there's so much to work with physically here. We know he's tough the same way we knew Justin Herbert was tough. We know he's a good kid the same way we knew Justin Herbert was a good kid. We know he's smart the same way we know Justin Herbert's smart. And then they look at it and they say, okay, Justin Herbert was able to work past some of the things that were perceived holes in his game and the pros. And maybe they feel like Justin Fields can do the same thing. And so I think from that standpoint, like the success of Justin Herbert with the Chargers, I think actually really does help Justin Fields.
Yeah. You know, and there's nothing like, I mean, it's too bad we didn't get to go to any kind of practices and stuff this year, but there's nothing like standing on the sidelines and watching a guy who can really throw the football, the football. Right. I mean, even Art Schleister said, you know, in my buddy Jeff Snook's book, he wrote with Art Schleister, you know, there was a difference between him and John Elway. John Elway had much bigger hands, could snap the, you know what I mean? Even among the elite, there is a level that you get to. Hey, last thing, Howard, how much do you enjoy doing what you do? I mean, and how much was it affected this year by not getting to get into locker rooms, et cetera, and really, you know, apply yourself?
I love what I do. You know, honestly, you know, working like, and I work long hours and you know, this, like this job requires you work weekends, you work nights. You know, I mean, I don't know, 80, 90 hour weeks aren't like that unusual. And it's hard to balance it with everything else, especially as you get older with kids and everything. But I always tell people, like, I just, like, it doesn't feel like work to me. And, you know, when I feel like I, you know, like it's like, it's not about like working until a certain point, it's working until I get the job done, you know? And I always, it's funny because I think about this stuff, and you know, you have those like little, like, you know, you have like those little like kind of moments in your job, and I'm sure they happen for you. For us, it's like a big trade happens, or you know, there's an injury you got to chase down, whatever it is. And it's like, I always think to myself when that stuff happens, it's like, if I was doing like a desk job somewhere, like my dad was a stockbroker, right? Like when he was younger and did that like his first, like, you know, I don't know, 8-9 years out of college. And it's like, I always used to think to myself, like, if I was doing one of those jobs, I would be sitting at my desk, like following what I'm doing for a job now anyway. So I'd be like sitting there, like, that's what I would be. I'd be like locked on to that stuff, you know? So, I mean, in that way, it really is sort of a dream come true that you get to do it for a living, you know, like, that, like the stuff that I would be doing anyway, the stuff that I would be following anyway. I mean, yeah, there are elements of it that are work. There's no question about that. It's a job like anything else, but I would be following this stuff anyway. And like in my free time, like I'm sitting with my kids and, you know, my two boys are 6 and 4, and you know, they were wearing their Justin Fields jerseys on Saturdays this fall. Like like that's what I'm doing my free time too. Like I'm watching college football. So, you know, I don't know. I feel really fortunate that I do what I do. And I, you know, football was a sport I played growing up, and it was a sport my dad sort of handed down to me. And, you know, the fact that like I get to cover the sport that like I would have chosen when I got into being, you know, a sports writer, sports reporter to begin with, it's just like, I'm really, really fortunate. And the fact that like, you can do it where you can provide for your family too. I mean, I'm sure you feel the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's awesome. You know what I mean? Like that's awesome. And I think anybody who works in sports understands that, because it's, there are a lot of people who want to get into it. And so because of that, when you are younger, you have to work for less money, sometimes no money. You have to work for a lot of hours, and it's a process of elimination. Because there are so many people who want to get into it, it's very easy to find people who are willing to do that. And, you know, like when you're 22, 23, 24 years old, again, it's just, and I went through it, I'm sure the same way you went through it. You see people just decide, screw this, I don't want to do this anymore. And it's sort of, you know, your willingness to kind of withstand those sorts of things and make it through. And I'm just really, I'm lucky that like I figured out what I wanted to do at a young age, and now I get to do it full time.
Yeah. I felt lucky my entire career, but I never, you know, I mean, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back. I never let myself think I've got it made or whatever. You know, there were young whippersnappers like Albert Breer and everybody coming up, et cetera. Number one, but number two, you know, it's like, I remember one time, one of the Ohio State coaches, I won't name, but he was going, Tim, you know, your guys, y'all got to learn, you know, this, that, and the other about, you know, staying in line, or, you know what I mean? Tony, I said, no, you don't understand, coach. I said, me and, you know, reporter B from like a Plain Dealer or something, Cleveland Plain Dealer, that's just like you and the coach from Michigan. I mean, we're not on the same team, you know?
I mean, that's the fun part about it for me too, is like that, like, you know, I'm competitive and I'm friends with a lot of people I compete with, but I, you know, like, I think like that's sort of, it does give you that, like where, you know, like one of the things that like, I remember, you know, like when I think like a lot of us, like I at one point was like, you know, kicking around the idea, do I want to coach? Do I want to try to be a GM? You know, and this is when you're younger and you're sort of thinking of what you want to do.
Yeah.
And like, I think one of the things that appealed about that to me was the idea that you get to go through wins and losses, right? Like, and that you get to feel the highs and the lows. And I always loved that about sports, right? Like there's always a scoreboard in the end. And, you know, I just loved competing. And I feel like this does, this job is the same thing. You're competing with so many different people. And, you know, every Monday, like I just tell you, every Monday for me, you know, the same way, like when I was younger, and young journalists don't have this anymore, but you remember the feeling of like looking at the other paper, right, Tim? Like, so you're sort of like, there's that second when you're opening it up where you're scared to death about what the other person has. And, but I have that now on Monday mornings with Peter, and I love Peter and he's been great. He's been a mentor to me, but I compete my ass off with Peter, and Peter does the same with me, you know? And and it's made me so much better. You know what I mean? Like, so there's absolutely that. I mean, you can see me light up when we get to this part of the conversation. Right. But like, I love competition, and I the idea that I get to compete, on like a day-to-day, week-to-week basis with so many other people that are really good at this is a great part of the job, no question.
Yeah, by the way, real quick before I go, when I first started covering Ohio State football, we were the afternoon paper and there was the morning paper, the Citizen Journal. And that really sucked because you spend all night, you know, and next day you get up and it either was or wasn't in their paper, but it was in mine, you know what I mean, so to speak. But
I mean, we probably sound so old right now, Tim, talking about the paper, but I can still remember because when I was covering the Patriots in 05 and 06, so I was writing for a suburban daily called the Metro West Daily News, which place was awesome for me. But we were owned by the Boston Herald, so a lot of times my stuff would be in the Herald. And so, you know, back then the internet was around, right? Like, but we would hold like they would hold stuff for the paper still at that point, right?
Oh yeah,
like,
we did the same thing. Yeah,
and it was probably a huge mistake and part of the reason why newspapers have had so many problems because they did stuff like that, right? But they would still hold stuff for the paper. And I can still remember, like, you know, I was living in the North End in Boston, and I can still remember going to like the convenience store down the street, and you pick up the papers, and there's the Globe, the Herald, the Providence Journal, and I remember like that feeling of your heart dropping when there was something in the other paper that you didn't have, and then that feeling of exhilaration when you knew you had something, and then you open up the other papers and it wasn't in there. So it's interesting that way. And in Boston, those papers, the early editions would hit the newsstands at like 1 a.m. So I could actually go after my shift and pick up the newspapers and see it. So I'll tell you what, Tim, that's never coming back.
No, now you just click on Twitter and see if somebody's just tweeted your scoop. You know what I mean? But you're right. That was kind of like after a Broadway show, going down and getting reading your review. You know what I mean? I mean, it's kind of like every day you got a report card, so to speak.
But you know what? Like, it was great because I honestly think like stuff like, and we're going way afield now, but I honestly think stuff like that makes everybody better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's tough. It's tough. Like, cause you're going to take some losses, but it's just, everybody's better in an environment like that. I
adopted a philosophy though a long time ago that, you know, when people would have like a scoop that I knew was not correct, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you gotta be really disciplined this now in Twitter, the Twitterverse. I just wouldn't even respond to it one way or the other because I never saw it as my job to prove or disprove.
Oh, that was the thing. Else. Yeah. Yes. So the interesting thing about that to me was like So I worked for both the Herald and the Globe, and then I worked for the Dallas Morning News, and when I was covering the Cowboys. And so for the Globe, it was interesting because the Herald was sort of the scrappy underdog, right? And so when I was there, they would like want you to call the Globe out, right? So if they had something wrong, it would be contrary to the report in the Globe, and they told me to do that. And like I remember there were times where I was like, oh God. And I wound up pissing some people off, but I was sort of just following marching orders on some of that stuff.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the Globe. It was like, if there's some other report that you're contradicting, say it. And then when I worked at the Globe and the Morning News, there was this, I guess, attitude. It's not news unless we report it. You know what I mean? Like, so if it didn't show up in our pages, like we weren't going to even acknowledge it. Right. Like, and I thought that was like always an interesting kind of difference between the number one paper in a town and then the number two paper in the town is that like, it's like you said, like, and I sort of like that because then I wouldn't have to like denigrate somebody for getting something wrong. You just basically act as if it never happened, you know? And I sort of felt like, despite there being some arrogance involved there too, probably like, I sort of like the idea that it was like, it's like confirming stuff, right? Like a lot of people in our business, it's like, well, I'm going to confirm it to get my name on it. That's not why you're confirming it. You're confirming it to make sure it's right. Like, that's why you're confirming it. You know what I mean? Like, and we all had to go through that where it was like we wouldn't be allowed to cite somebody else back then. It was, no, we need to make sure this is right before we put it in the paper. And So it was just sort of an interesting subtle difference between the between different places. But yeah, I mean, I'm with you. Like when I was at the Globe, when I was at the Morning News, it was, if somebody has something wrong and we haven't had anything on it, leave it alone. And if, you know, it was just sort of like, if we haven't confirmed it for ourselves, like if we haven't seen it with our own two eyes,
right,
then, you know, then it's, then it doesn't rise to the level that, that it doesn't rise to the level where we're going to put it in the paper. And I think there'd be a lot less stuff that was wrong out there now if people approached reporting that way.
But yeah,
we are where we are. Now I sound now I sound like the old arrogant like Globey or
No, I said online, you'd rather be right than first, you know.
Yeah.
You want to be first, but you'd rather
But it's all credibility. That's
exactly.
It's like people are only going to keep coming back to me if they think that like what they're reading is if there's truth in what I'm reading, what they're reading, and you know, I'm not only accountable to my readers, I'm accountable to the people in the league too. I need them to keep talking to me. And the only way they keep talking to me, like, you know, this as well as I do, like 90% of my job is building and maintaining relationships. Yeah. If they don't talk to me anymore, then I'm screwed. Then what I do, then my value is gone. And so, you know, I need to be able to build and maintain those relationships. And if I can build and maintain those relationships, I can be good at my job. And to build and maintain those relationships, I need to be right. Like, I have like 99.9% of the time.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about predictions, but when you're reporting facts, like, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's my favorite line is that, you know, when somebody says they're citing a source about something, my problem is I have no idea who their source is. You know what I mean? So why would I rely on somebody? I know who all my sources are. And, you know, you'll be working on a story just like somebody else. They may break it ahead of you, but, you know, until you get it from somebody you definitely trust, you know, you're not going to write it. So, you know what I mean? It's just one of those kind of things. Real quick, when you were Dallas, you worked with, or you worked with one of my best friends, Rich Dalrymple, you know, the PR guy for the Cowboys. Yeah. He helped me build my patio in Upper Arlington way back when in our starter home, my wife and I. And, you know, he got his start at Otterbein College.
Did he really? Wow.
He's been with Jerry Jones now for 30-something years, man. That deserves an award unto itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Rich has been there forever. I mean, Rich is sort of a legend in the PR world. It's and he's seen a lot of things now too. If he ever wanted to write the tell-all book, I think he'd have some pretty good stories.
Yeah. I keep telling him, man, keep taking notes, man. He goes, no. But Albert, I gotta go, man. But man, I really appreciate you coming on the Tim May podcast, brother.
You got it, Tim. I always say, hey, like I said, I mean this seriously. It's an honor to be on with you. What was it? Some like 20 years after I was the snot-nosed kid there on the Ohio State beat. So I'm happy to come on whenever you want me.
Dude, you've always been nice to me. If you're nice to me, I'm nice to you. That's my mantra in life. And by the way, you read that last part exactly the way I wrote it. I appreciate that.
I always stick to the script.
Have a good day, Albert. Appreciate it, man.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
I want to really thank Albert Breer for coming on the Tim May podcast. You know, he and I've talked off and on for years. And like we talked about before, you know, you and I talked about before we went to the interview there, you know, he remembers that being at the Lantern working with guys like me and, you know, people giving you pointers in life that can be invaluable. But then you got to go out and really you got to do the work yourself, man. You got to develop, you know, that work ethic. And I think you're either born with a work ethic or you're not. You know, there are a lot of guys we've seen come and go in this business, right, Austin, who just weren't really ready for the it's not 9 to 5. It's about about 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. most days when you've got to be ready to jump at a moment's notice. And some people are cut out for that and most people aren't.
Well, I mean, I just think back to the start of my career and it's not the same for everybody anymore, but you know, going into work desk shifts and take phone calls from, you know, high school games and lay out the paper itself, you know, pagination.
Yep.
You know, when I got the Wyoming football beat, that was, you know, 6 months, not 365 days a year like Ohio State football, but, you know, I covered Wyoming football when that season was over, when spring ball was over. I mean, I'm covering high schools and soccer games. And then when you're working those desk shifts, you're waiting till the last games are done on the West Coast to put the paper to bed. So I even reporting about, like what you're saying, your phone is always on, especially now that we have these in our pocket, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. But if you don't really love the work and along with sports, you got to love them both equally, in my opinion, to be good at it. You're not going to last very long. And you see the ones who, you know, like Albert, that make the most of it, that put everything they have into it. It's the only way, you know. Yeah. I know what I said earlier on in the show, like that can be true for all professions, but this is the one I know. And that's definitely true of this one.
Yeah, and quality shows, man. That's why he has such a great following. Quality shows, the work he puts into it, and the talent he has for that job, knowing people all across the country and scooping left and right, et cetera. It's pretty interesting the way he's gone about it and taking over for Peter King, you know. And like I talked about in that podcast, you know, Peter King used to be sort of a compadre, but now Peter King is, in essence, a competitor, you know. So you have to put him on a different burner on the stove. But, it's funny because I've also prefaced with the fact that you and I were going to get into the coaching carousel situation after my conversation with Albert. And it's really interesting bringing on Paul Rhodes in the capacity that Ryan Day has, which, you know, I don't know if that's a first really for Ryan Day, but this is a guy who's a former head coach. I'm talking about in Paul Rhodes, who has got pretty good reputation, you know, especially from defensive football, but football in general. And now you're kind of throwing him in to the mix, you know, with this group of coaches. And just how do you think that's going to go, Austin?
Yeah, somebody asked me that the other day, Tim, like, was this the first analyst? I mean, no, not really.
Because, no, not really.
Yeah, the quality control people count as that. They never call them that. And I think officially that's what Paul Rhodes will be as well. And so, you know, these have been around, but this is a different path where Alabama is the one that's brought so much of this to prominence with really hiring an army of behind the scenes assistants, but also guys with really high profiles, you know, a Butch Jones, Bill O'Brien, you know, I mean, Bill O'Brien's a full-time, Butch Jones, we guess would be the most popular example, but Charlie Strong did that for Alabama as well, where they
are. Sarkisian did it. Yeah. Oh, you're talking about on defense. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, I was trying to think of just like some of the really high profile, like former head coaches doing this role. And even Paul Rhodes doesn't necessarily, you know, move the needle the same way some of these guys that Nick Saban has brought in. But I think that this is a little bit of a, for Ohio State anyway, a compromise between the two, where Ryan Day prefers to, you know, have younger guys, up and comers in the profession, people that he can one day envision having a full-time role, you know, thinking of what just happened with Parker Fleming. Corey Dennis did that a year ago. You know, his situation would not be the exact same, but, you know, Keenan Bailey, you know, that new coach down there in Jacksonville tried to hire him in the last few weeks, and Keenan Bailey elected to stay. Not a lot of people are doing that. So the loyalty thing goes both ways, but that's the way that Ohio State had been trying to build their staff. This is a unique way that they could try and fulfill that. When we talked about Greg Madison, the veteran presence, the helping the other coaches, because he's not going to be working directly with players. He can't be out there on the practice field leading drills. This is more about a move for the coaches. And I think that it's interesting because, anymore you have to have it. Like if Clemson and Alabama have it, you have to have it.
Yeah, I'm just interested from a chemistry standpoint. Obviously, Greg, you know, it's almost like you're replacing Greg Madison, this, you know, what do you want to call him, august coach. I mean, you know, maybe more of an October-esque coach, but you're replacing him and all the wisdom and experience he brought to the table along with coaching. You're replacing him now kind of like twofold. You're getting Paul Rhodes, who's been around the country, you know, and obviously was a head coach at Iowa State and actually did a pretty good job there, in my opinion. Iowa State's a tough road to hoe. That's where Tom Herman was working for Paul Rhodes when Urban Meyer hired him as his offensive coordinator. But this is a guy that's been around a lot of programs. And so he kind of replaces that, maybe that experience factor to a certain extent that Greg Madison brought to bear in the defensive meetings. And yet you're still bringing up that young, you know, the young guy, you know, I mean, you're bringing up the young guy and bringing him along. I'm just wondering how the dynamic's going to work in the meeting rooms, you know, is Paul, is he going to be sitting in the corner going, yeah, you're right, Kerry. LJ or Coach Johnson, wherever he's going to call Coach Johnson. Yeah, that's a good bar. Or is he going to be going, I don't know about that. I don't know if I would do it that way. You know what I mean? You just kind of wonder how that kind of all works and how much Ryan Day is going to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, and I think that what the goal here would be is that you want a fresh set of eyes that maybe bring a new idea or two, but it's also not somebody who is going to be overhauling the system. You know, one question that was asked, you know, to me was like, man, no, Paul Rhodes hasn't had very good defenses, you know, in the last couple of years. And Iowa State, you know, petered off the end. And like, okay, for one, he wasn't exactly working with the same personnel that Ohio State has. For two, he's not coming here to be the defensive coordinator or replace Kerry Combs. If he has a thing or two that might work in the secondary, a tweak where they might need to, you know, if they've been weak against a certain part, or, you know, they want to play more press coverage, or, you know, whatever, cover three, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's not for me to decide. I'm not in that room, but, you know, if there's a different way to do it subtly, then that's what Paul Rhodes would be here for. If Ryan Day had given up on what he wants from that defense after 2 years, which, you know, they were pretty damn good under Jeff Hafley there in 2019.
Yeah.
Number four in the country in total defense. You know, I don't think that he's, you know, throwing everything out because of what happened last year. There were a lot of reasons to explain it, but there may still be a tweak or two that can be made. So I guess the point is, like, in Ryan Day's conversations with Paul Rhodes, you know, do you believe that this is the right way to play defense? Are we on the right path with that? Do you agree? You think that this is the way it should be played in this era of college football? And then how can you help us make that better?
Yeah, exactly. How can you help them teach it?
Yeah.
You know, and does it fit the personnel? I mean, that's the big deal anymore. You know, Ryan Day talks about that. Urban Meyer talked about that. Will it fit to personnel? Yeah. And obviously Ohio State is looking for some answers after finishing 122nd in the nation in pass defense. I mean, that's not a good stat no matter how you – no matter how you blanket it, and especially when you put an exclamation point on the end like that Alabama game. But I keep reminding people that Alabama offense, you know, they might see that once a year, you know, and they saw it that one time and probably would like another shot at it, maybe get the change of things. That's what Albert Breer and I were talking about. He did a big piece on his Monday morning quarterback offering this week on Todd Bowles and the way Tampa Bay got after Patrick Mahomes and Kansas City in that wide open offense with just basic approach, you know, and it did wonders. And that's what, you know, it's keep it simple, stupid is the right way of going about things when you've got talented people. And that was kind of like Todd Bowles' approach. Just go out there and do your job is to paraphrase Bill Belichick. And so we'll see. You know, like you pointed out many times, we're going to talk about this before spring opens too, if and when spring drills do open. But we're going to talk about a little bit more about the secondary, but just, you know, the attrition they dealt with last year from the secondary standpoint, not just on people who got kicked off the team, people who left early, and then but also people who got injured and weren't available at the end of the year. I mean, they were really robbing Peter to pay Paul. So there are a lot of reasons why that secondary had problems at the end of the year, right?
Yeah, and, you know, people are probably tired of hearing it from me, but I think that it's worth putting that in context when, yeah, no one anywhere thinks that finishing number 122 in pass defense is a positive or acceptable.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not suggesting that it is, but I think that it's easy to forget all the other issues that they were dealing with. And beyond that, you know, when you brought it up, Tim, like, you're robbing Peter, like, Marcus Williamson is not a safety. Well, somebody had to play safety, and you don't get to sign a free agent off the street in college football.
Correct.
That's not the way it works. Somebody had to go do it, and they had to do it on short notice. And, you know, Marcus Williamson did a pretty good job about of that, I think, because he was playing a lot better at the end of the year than he was at the start. And that was also without the benefit of, you know, normal practices and, you know, one padded practice before the national title game and to try and get ready for that offense. Like, that's just 1 week. And I know if people want to, you know, however you want to put that in context, go for it. But not having Court Williams, not having Cameron Brown, both of those guys are the way that you go into the Big Ten title game and have no healthy safeties, basically.
Yeah.
Top three out. And then Josh Proctor has to go do something different. You know, if people want to be super critical of what happened in 2020 on defense, you know, there's nothing I can do to change their mind. Everyone has their own opinion about things, but, you know,
exactly.
Do I think that Ohio State played great pass defense last year? No. Do I understand what may have caused that? I think that I do.
Yeah, I do too. That's why we're going to spend almost a full segment on it before spring, because you and I are going to figure out how to fix it. And then maybe we'll get some analyst money. What do you think?
Well, you and I both have Kerry's number. We'll let him know that we're available.
Good point. Hey, real quick before we go, Al Washington Jr., he didn't snub his nose at Tennessee, but basically decided to stay at The Ohio State University.
Yep.
Were you surprised by that move by him?
Yes and no. I know how you love it when I play both sides, but the amount of money, you know, that's why the decision took so long. He also, you know, my understanding is that Al Washington really was impressed by Josh Heupel and Tennessee's commitment to him. So those were things that made it hard, because the raise that was offered to him was so significant.
Yeah.
You know, just life-changing amount of money. On the flip side, we talked about this before when he was weighing the decision a week ago. Like, Tennessee right now, they're going to probably be, you know, sanctioned because they investigated themselves, which in the SEC is unheard of. That should send off some, you know, flashing neon signs, warning signs to tell you to stay away.
House detective, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, normally, how about this way, Tim? If an SEC school investigates itself, it's probably not going to find anything. This was done on purpose.
Kevin Bacon, nothing to see here.
Yeah, and found something. So that information is now freely available to the NCAA. They said we had to fire our coach because of this to save themselves some money. Okay, the NCAA, that's about the only way they can win a case anymore is if you make it for them. So that's going to happen. This has been going on with uncertainty for their administration dating back to when I worked there, which has been a long time now. But
I was going to say, man.
Yeah, 15 years.
Wait, let's remind people. You worked there. What years did you work in the working mightily to cover the Tennessee beat?
Yeah, so I was there on two occasions when I was a much younger man in 2006 and 2004. Then I was there full-time as the Tennessee beat reporter for the Knoxville News Sentinel from 2009 to 2011. So Lane Kiffin's year, so the first year post-Fulmer where everything was truly getting insane because you had so many people, which then this continued for the next 12 years. Fulmer trying to fight to get his power back, people that were living in 1998 trying to restore him to power. Lane Kiffin exacerbating things by leaving in the middle of the night after 1 year to go to USC and leaving some wreckage and smoldering couches in the street outside the practice facility. Rushing into a 3-day hire of Derek Dooley. I think it's like, you know, 4 athletic directors, 6 coaches, and, you know, it's been an absolute – it's not going to stop just because of Danny White and Josh Heupel. In fact, to get way off track, I think Central Florida would have made this trade for Malzahn and any other AD maybe. I think they came out way ahead of Tennessee. But anyway, the point is that's also – all that craziness has to be considered by Al Washington as well. Ohio State is as solid a place as can be. It's his hometown. He's still one of the highest paid assistant coaches in the country. He recruited all these linebackers that are here. Tennessee's got like 30 players in the portal. I don't even know how they're going to field a team next year. So, you know, all this is part of it. And I think it was still hard just because the money was so significant.
Yeah. Agreed.
You got me way off.
I want to give people some context. I mean, you know what you're talking about when it comes to the wacky, wacky, wacky world of Tennessee volunteer football anymore. You know, I mean, 1998, I mean, you know, they basically, I don't think they even interviewed T. Martin, if I'm not mistaken, right? I mean, for this job, that's interesting. I mean, they're really going all, it's kind of like hiring Derek Dooley all over again a little bit, except Josh Heupel does have some cred, but like you said, he may have been getting out of town ahead of the posse also. So, and Gus Malzahn, you know, and, you know, wow, it's just the carousel never ends, right?
Well, and Gus Malzahn is a much better fit for Tennessee, to be honest. I think, I mean, he's obviously going to score a ton of points with UCF, but somebody with SEC experience, somebody who's been talked about, you know, was he playing up to his potential at Auburn at the end? Maybe, maybe not. I mean, it's hard to beat Nick Saban and have to deal with him 365 days a year in that rivalry and in that league. And also sometimes you just benefit from going somewhere else and trying something new after a while. We've seen that, you know, with Urban Meyer or the end of the Jim Tressel era. Sometimes it's just – sometimes a change does everybody good.
Sure.
Anyway, I'm not here to try and fix Tennessee by saying that Gus Malzahn should have gone there, but it's just all that adds up. And also, like, Josh Heupel runs an up-tempo offense. So Al Washington's statistical defenses, if he was running them for the Vols, might not have been that impressive. They might not have helped him get the next job. There's no guarantee with this depleted roster and the itchy trigger finger that Tennessee has had with coaches over the years that it would go beyond the three-year deal, which is what he was being offered. So, you know, you sit down and everybody wants, like, as soon as you hear that an offer's out, everybody wants a decision anymore. Like, and it took longer than I thought it would, Tim, for him to decide. But, like, think about all that stuff that I just crammed into 3 minutes. Like,
oh yeah,
there's so much on his plate that he had to weigh.
You talk about a salmon swimming upstream with a backpack on his back. I mean, that's kind of the situation you're going into. He may be the most prized salmon out there, but it's still swimming upstream right now, man. It's crazy. So real quick, not an yes or no, but give me succinct before we get out of here. Do you think Ryan Day comes out ahead in this whole deal now? I mean, what is your sense of the staff that he has right now?
Yeah.
It looks like he feels extremely happy with the way things have worked out.
Yeah, I think that that decision was pretty significant for Ohio State. And I say this where every linebackers coach in the country would have taken a number to get that job. They could have hired somebody else. You know, they could have moved forward. There's no reason that Al Washington would make or break the program from a position coach standpoint. But he's the guy that they want to do it. They believe in him. Ryan Day's known him a long time. They prize that continuity. I mean, that's why Parker Fleming was promoted. That really helped determine everything, that Al can handle the linebackers, that he's recruited at a high level, and that he knows the personnel. So he did need – Ryan Day did need that to happen. And the rest, I think he's got what he wanted. And we talked about the Fleming thing before. Like, this is the staff he wants. He doesn't have to go into the middle of February and look for somebody else. This was a good deal for Ryan Day.
And I'll tell you what. Him hiring C.J. Barnett to replace Ryan Stamper in that role—that's a win, man. I mean, I'm going to be disappointed if that's not a win. Ryan Stamper, you and I both know he's one of the great individuals we've ever known, but so is C.J. Barnett. And coming from the Columbus Police Force to now join, and then basically in essence, you know, he runs, you know, that guy runs the Real Life Wednesday programs. He runs all these things behind the scenes. We all know Ryan Stamper being famous for those post-practice black stripes being pulled off things and all that stuff. But C.J. Barnett, man, he is quite the competent fellow to put into that spot. That was a real win.
I would bet that if you asked Ryan Stamper when he was on the way out of the Woody exit interview, who should replace you, C.J. Barnett would have had to have been one of the first two or three, if not the first name that he mentioned. Now, CJ has never been – like some of the stuff that Stamp is so good at that you talked about, the way that people recognize him, the black stripe, that really helped shine a light and brought him, you know, into the spotlight. That's not necessarily CJ Barnett's strength. He may need to work on that. But Ryan Stamper didn't – you know, was never doing it in the first place to, like, make a name for himself or get the attention. Just kind of became the tradition. So we'll see if that sticks and if that becomes the role for CJ Barnett moving forward. All the other stuff, though – you know, community outreach, Real Life Wednesdays, you know, dealing with police officers and making sure that, you know, everybody's being fine, upstanding citizens.
Being unafraid or unfettered about getting into a player's face, done wrong or maybe doing wrong, et cetera. Go ahead, though. I wanted to throw that in there, too. That's as important a piece of that job as anything else.
Well, that's the other part of it. You can't – you're not going to go, like, BS Ryan Stamper. That's not going to work.
And that's now
TJ Barnett can become – you know, the stuff that he did – obviously, he was a fiery leader, captain at the end of his career. That part would never faze him. But now he's also seen a bunch of other stuff that makes you mature and makes you not really scared of almost anything that you can encounter. You're not going to go in there and, like, you know, try and pull a fast one on CJ Barnett either. That's that's another big part of this.
Like, I love that CJ Barnett stare, you know, and it's, you know, it's not like, it's like just like looking right through you like, yeah, right, buddy.
It's serious.
Well, anyway, that's interesting. We're going to come back in the next couple of weeks. We're going to start looking into the spring and what the big battles are. We know the number one battle that everybody's curious about. That's starting running back, right? No, I'm just joking. I am writing a story finally for us on that, just how that may go down, et cetera. And it's really, really interesting because there's a corral. There's a corral of wannabes there, man, who want to come out of that gate as fast as possible this spring, if in fact they get to have a spring. And that's what's going to make it as interesting as anything else. But yeah, we're going to talk about the quarterback situation. We're going to talk about what they're going to do in the middle of that offensive line with the people they've got to replace from where they're going to end up, et cetera. And it promises to be an interesting spring without a doubt, right?
Can't wait. Hope we get there. Yeah. I know we won't really get to see any of it, but just to talk about it and maybe get some feedback. I'm as ready for it as ever. Let's get back to some normal-ish football.
Well, sometimes, you know, nobody was riding with Lindbergh when he flew across the Atlantic. You kind of had to take his word for all the things he went through, but it's still interesting and compelling. So that's what this spring is going to be kind of like for Ohio State, man. They're big shoes to fill on both sides of the ball. But you know what? Until next week, this is Tim May with the Tim May Podcast. As usual, I want to thank my buddy Awesome. You know him as Austin Ward coming on. And, of course, my good friend Albert Breer from the Monday Morning Quarterback fame. Keep reading his stuff, man. He always is in-depth in his analysis of the Tampa Bay defense and how they got after Patrick Mahomes in Kansas City is worth the read. But until next week, this is Tim May with the Tim May Podcast. We'll see you then.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.